chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you say it coming, no time to play out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, there'll be no doubt when you see you are. Rest my dab in the middle of it.
The secret truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler. We've got quite a program going this evening. A lot has been going on. Pelosi did go to Taiwan, and she's gotten sanctioned now by the Chinese government, and they're pulling back on negotiations with us on several different topics and issues. So there have been some repercussions. The Chinese are carrying out a drill, an exercise totally around the Turtle Island now, and it looks like that they might be practicing for either a blockade or a boycott of some kind of Taiwan in the future. But first, we've got Steve Bannon, who attended the CPAC meeting up in Dallas, Texas. And he talks about we are at war. And then he follows with a small comment after that, that you'll be surprised that it was uttered at CPAC. First, we're going to go with Steve Bannon, we are at war.
We're at war. We are at war. We're at a political and ideological war. You can say anything else you want about it, but we're at war. Think about after high noon on the 20th of January 2021, when an illegitimate imposter took over 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue and took over an administration. There is no doubt in anybody's mind that's looked at the facts and look at the information from Arizona and Wisconsin and Michigan and Georgia and the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania that the 2020 election was stolen from Donald J. Trump. And all the Republicans and all the controlled opposition that says, oh, it's about the future, it's about the future, elections are about now. We cannot go forward. This is not about President Trump. This is not about Donald J. Trump. This is issues far deeper than President Trump. This is about this republic, what was bequeathed to us and what we're going to bequeath to our children and our grandchildren. If we're prepared to sit here, if you're prepared to sit here and have them steal an election, they told you how they were going to steal it. Mark Elias and the Transition Integrity Project that came out months before and said, hey, don't pay attention to election night. Because at 10 or 11 o'clock is going to be a red tsunami, but just wait, just wait, just wait. Because when all the mail-in ballots are counted with no signature verification, in 3 weeks, Joe Biden will be president of the United States. They told you how they're going to do it. Is this familiar, Carrie Lake? Right? You sit there and you work and you work and you work, and what they want to do is these phony mail-in ballots with no signature verification and steal these elections.
Steve Bannon is being prosecuted or attacked by the January 6th committee, and they're going after him with indictments and so forth on not showing up at those hearings. And executive privilege is what he's maintaining. And so the next utterance that he made at the CPAC was about the Fed. Now, Ron Paul had as his motto and as his one of his goals was end the Fed way back in the mid-2000, you know, 2008, 10, right in there. And we joined in with that. But here we go with Steve Bannon saying that outright, end the Fed, and saying that it's privately owned and who it's owned by. This is unprecedented. Things can change, but I'm fearful what's going to happen.
One last thing. The biggest scam they have, the biggest con, is not just the appropriations process and how they fund it. It's the Federal Reserve.
Okay? Okay? 0.5% of the citizens of this country own more assets than the bottom 90%. That's all happened over the last 10 years since 2008. Now, we took a monetary base of what, back in the 80s of what, $800 billion? The balance sheet of the Fed was $880 billion under President Bush, right? Balance sheet of the Fed is $9.5 trillion today. The debt's $30 trillion. We have $100 to $150 trillion contingent liabilities. All just because we're the prime reserve currency. The greatest export we have is the dollar. But all of that rests on the shoulders of our children and our grandchildren. Those are all due bills that are come due. All we've done is crank up. We've just cranked everything up. That's why they're talking about these ridiculous, insane bills of trillions of dollars. Because the Federal Reserve will print the money. The Federal Reserve, by the way, that's owned not by the American people, a central bank that's owned by 24 prime brokers, being J.P. Morgan and Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley. How does that work? And governors that kind of selected, but, you know, 12 years. And the best governor we've had in the Federal Reserve right here in Dallas, Richard Fisher, who told you what was going to happen by going to negative interest rates, told you what was going to happen by printing all this money and having $4, $5, $6 trillion, $7 trillion, $8 trillion, now $9 trillion on the balance sheet of the Federal Reserve. It's going to cause, you talk inequality, it's not a $15 minimum wage, that's tip money. We have, I think M2 today is what, $22 or $23 trillion. That's how the administrative state pays for itself. We don't need to audit the Fed. We need to end the Federal Reserve. The Federal Reserve has usurped its power and the power of the American people and our elective representatives. And no, they do not have the consent of the governed. We will not comply. We will not submit. And it must be ended.
The two statements that he made, first about we are at war, and then secondly, in the Fed, are, boy, those are outstanding, outspoken type of statements to be made. And what's coming up next is an interview on about 2,000 mules. And it's interesting because they did prove that the drop boxes, we were defrauded during the election by at the drop box level. But here we go with that interview that on the Alex Jones show. Here we go next.
If the evidence of the film is solid, which I believe it is, in effect, what we're saying is that the wrong guy's in the Oval Office, that Joe Biden is a usurper to the degree that it's illegal fraud organized by the left and by the Democrats to put him in office. And so his presence, Kamala Harris's presence, and obviously Merrick Garland's job are all based upon the success of that fraud. So what realistic expectation can we have that if we go to them, they're going to be the ones to crack down on the fraud that put them where they are? My view at the beginning, and this comes out of the Reagan years, I thought, well, look, you know, this is an academic debate. You've got two sides that have different views of America. We put both them before the American people, and the American people choose. It wasn't until I sat across from these kind of Obama Justice Department lawyers, and I realized that that's not how they see me at all. They don't see me as a critic, someone who disagrees with them. They see me as an enemy that they need to destroy. If they could have locked me up for 20 years for that trivial violation, they would have done it. Let's note that in Yuma, Arizona, in Yuma County, the sheriff watched the movie and opened up an immediate criminal investigation. He's looking at ballot trafficking in Yuma. Now, we interview a mule in the movie. She was busted for ballot trafficking. She's cooperating with the authorities. That's how we could get her in the film. And so that's the first sign, but it's an important sign, that this film is going to have a real prosecutorial impact.
Well, if I went over his bio, it would take us an hour, but he was in the Reagan administration, did incredible work for America. He's an American success story that came to this country and knocked it out of the park. He has been a best-selling author. He has been a bigger filmmaker than really any documentary filmmaker out there in the last 50 years. The biggest numbers, the biggest gross. He really is a cultural icon, and that's why he was also a political prisoner, absolutely framed in campaign finance for doing nothing wrong. And we saw the same thing with Rick Perry, charged when he vetoed a Democrat bill. Part of the law, the governor can veto a bill. The same group's trying to put me in jail right now. So he's a hero, ladies and gentlemen, Dinesh D'Souza. And if anybody's going to turn the tide, it's people like him and the folks, of course, like James O'Keefe, that just keep dropping bombshell after bombshell. This is real investigative journalism. This is real filmmaking. I've watched 2,000 Mules three times. And it is just smoking gun evidence of how they did it. They used the red herring of saying it was machines. We exposed it back at the time. No, it was the mules. They said the red wave was coming, the red mirage, but they would get the votes they needed. And now a bunch of Democrat-controlled states have announced that they're going to allow ballots for 7 days after the midterms to be mailed in. So this is their strategy. It's how they're doing it. Joining us for the next 30 minutes or so is Dinesh D'Souza of 2000mules.com, at Dinesh D'Souza on Twitter. Again, sir, I don't get starstruck by really anybody, but the work you've done for this country and my family and our culture and the world is unmeasurable. Thank you so much for not buckling under the pressure.
Well, Alex, that certainly means a lot. And I also want to give a lot of credit here to the election intelligence group called True the Vote, because they provided the research foundation for this movie. They came to me and they said, we got to show you some stuff. I looked at it and I was like, I'm looking at a caliber of evidence I haven't seen before in this area. And I convinced them. I said, look, do not put this out in dribs and drabs because the left will swat you down. Let's put the whole story together in a movie. It's the appropriate intellectual and emotional venue to do this. And fortunately, they trusted me to unfurl this story. And boy, is the left having problems with this movie, which, by the way, is going into wide release in theaters this coming weekend, Friday, May 20th, 400 theaters, 4 showings a day. So, you know, you can go catch it in the theater this weekend. Please do.
Absolutely incredible. And by any measurement, this is already a blockbuster, not just for a documentary, and it's only gaining steam. A massive first release, first online, then, of course, DVD, and now into theaters. Let's talk about the film and then their response and what's happened since it was released a few weeks ago.
The left has unleashed their familiar battery of fact checkers. And normally these are sort of, these are guys with truncheons, and they're normally capable of shutting any such venture down very quickly. Unproven allegations, blah, 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 conspiracy theory, most secure election in history, big lie. But I think once they saw this film, and even from seeing the trailer, they realized that's not going to work here, because not only do we have electronic, which is to say, cell phone geo-tracking, which places the criminals at the scene of the crime unmistakably. I mean, you can give your cell phone to your wife, but the fact that that cell phone was at that scene is not open to dispute. And then surveillance video, 4 million minutes of it. We have a lot of this footage in the movie. So you begin to realize the stupidity of the fact checkers. Well, maybe, Dinesh, this is a guy who's taking the votes of his family members. And I'm like, well, okay, but would a normal person like that go to 10 or more drop boxes in the middle of the night wearing gloves, taking photos of the ballots as they go into the box? This makes absolutely no sense. So the left has got something here that they don't know how to handle. They're trying desperately to explain it, and they cannot.
And again, you guys, this company went out and was able to buy the data from the apps and the telephone companies that then shows how they went to the safe houses, the NGOs, how they then delivered them around the town, sometimes going to dozens of locations. Then you're able to go get the surveillance footage that is at each location, actually show them doing it, taking the photo to prove that they did their job, then taking their gloves off, throwing it in the trash can, and they're just doing this in a very mechanized military fashion.
Yeah, they're picking up these mules. The mule is just the paid operative who's delivering these illegal votes and is hired to do so by a left-wing organization. So they stop at these vote stash houses. That's where they get the ballots. They don't come up with their own. They're given a backpack or a satchel full of ballots. And by the way, they're instructed, don't go and drop all the ballots in one box. Why? Because if you go put 300 ballots in one box, the next day when the election officials open the boxes, there'll be a massive spike. And so they're instructed, 3 ballots here, 5 ballots there, 8 ballots here. And that's why the mules go on these routes to multiple drop boxes. And this is how it was actually, we found a way, just an ingenious way that True the Vote devised to bust them by tracking their phones.
And as you said, the so-called fact checkers are apoplectic. They don't know what to do. This is open and shut information. But where's the Justice Department? Where's the FBI? We know that USPS drivers and others would find tens of thousands of ballots all pre-marked for Biden from one state to another. They thought it was suspicious, and then the FBI came and threatened them.
Well, if you ask me where the Justice Department is, I would honestly say that they're probably trying to figure out ways that they can diffuse this story, because the Justice Department today should be understood as a kind of consigliere operation for the mafia. In other words, what I'm getting at is if the evidence of the film is solid, which I believe it is, in effect, what we're saying is that the wrong guy's in the Oval Office, that Joe Biden is a usurper to the degree that it's illegal fraud organized by the left and by the Democrats to put him in office. And so his presence, Kamala Harris's presence, and obviously Merrick Garland's job are all based upon the success of that fraud. So what realistic expectation can we have that if we go to them, they're going to be the ones to crack down on the fraud that put them where they are?
So go to the 2000 Mules site, and you'll be able to either order from there, or I think InfoWars has it, but order the 2000 Mules and look at that, and you'll see that there was cheating, mass cheating on the Dropbox level. But that's what we're concerned about, is what there was cheating during that. And next coming up is DeSantos talks about suspending a state attorney down in Tampa, Florida, and he's interviewed. First, I'm going to play the actual speech that he made in reaching his conclusions and his decision, and then I'm going to play Tucker Carlson interview, and then I'm going to come back and play what the sheriff of that county had to say about that action that Governor Santos had made. But here we go with actually DeSantos' speech about dismissing and suspending an attorney.
Thank you. Thanks to Sheriff Chronister for having us here for today's announcement, and we're glad that we're back in Hillsborough County. Our government is a government of laws, not a government of men. And what that means is that we govern ourselves based on a constitutional system and based on the rule of law. But yet we've seen across this country over the last few individual prosecutors take it upon themselves to determine which laws they like and will enforce and which laws they don't like and then don't enforce. And the results of this in cities like Los Angeles and San Francisco have been catastrophic. You could go in San Francisco and steal a certain amount of merchandise, and you just would, by definition, not be prosecuted. That has undermined public safety. It has really hurt these communities, and it's been devastating to the rule of law. So as I saw that happening across the country earlier this year, I asked my staff in my office to look around the state of Florida and to make sure that that was not going to happen here, where you would have individual prosecutors nullify laws that were enacted by the people's representatives. They spoke with law enforcement throughout the state. They spoke with line prosecutors throughout the state. And it all came back to this area here in the 13th Judicial Circuit in Hillsborough County. And the response that we got was a lot of frustration on the part of law enforcement for criminals being let go and crimes not being prosecuted. And so we looked into it, and we compiled a lot of the record. And I can tell you it's been a very, very troubling record. So the prosecutor, state attorney for this judicial circuit, Andrew Warren, has put himself publicly above the law. In June of 2021, he signed a letter saying that he would not enforce any prohibitions on sex change operations for minors. And that's a debate that we're having mostly administratively and through medical licensing in Florida, but other states have enacted penalties on the people that would perform those, which are really disfiguring these young kids. And he said, it doesn't matter what the legislature does in the state of Florida, he's going to exercise a veto over that. He's also instituted policies of, quote, presumptive non-enforcement. And this involves an array of different things, and you'll probably hear Sheriff Chronister and some of the other law enforcement officers talk about it. But that is not consistent with the role of a prosecutor. Yes, you can exercise discretion in an individual case, but that discretion has to be individualized and case-specific. You can't just say you're not going to do certain offenses. And then most recently, after the Dobbs decision was rendered by the U.S. Supreme Court, he signed a letter saying he would not enforce any laws relating to protecting the right to life in the state of Florida. And mind you, we have had prohibition on third trimester abortions for a long time. We've had prohibitions on partial birth abortions for a long time. And then most recently, the legislature enacted and I signed protections for unborn babies at 3.5 months. And when they are aborted, it's typically done through a dismemberment procedure, which is really inhumane. Nevertheless, that is what the legislature has enacted, and it's not for him to put himself above that and say that he is not going to enforce the laws. We don't elect people in one part of the state to have veto power over what the entire state decides on these important issues. The Constitution of Florida has vested the veto power in the governor, not in individual state attorneys. And so when you flagrantly violate your oath of office, when you make yourself above the law, you have violated your duty, you have neglected your duty, and you are displaying a lack of competence to be able to perform those duties. And so today we are suspending State Attorney Andrew Warren, effective immediately. We are not going to allow this pathogen that's been around the country of ignoring the law. We are not going to let that get a foothold here in the state of Florida. We are going to make sure that our laws are enforced and that no individual prosecutor puts himself above the law. And I can tell you the states and the localities that have allowed this to happen, they are ruining the day. You want to know why some people are moving to Florida? Because their communities are no longer safe thanks to prosecutors that think they know better than the people's representatives and they get to pick and choose which laws that they are enforcing. So this was something that had a lot of input around the state. This is something that I think is a very, very important issue across our country, that this movement would be allowed to take hold, where you basically elevate your own personal conception of, quote, social justice over what the law requires of you. And I would note, those who say this represents social justice, look at San Francisco. They had to recall this prosecutor who was put in, funded by people like George Soros, saying he's not going to prosecute. They did the recall election. He was recalled, even in a very liberal jurisdiction, but the places that voted to keep him were the affluent communities who are not bearing the brunt of the policies. The places that voted to recall him were the working class communities because they bear the burden of ignorance and refusal to enforce the law. And so what this is all about is really, when you uphold the rule of law, you are protecting the most vulnerable in our society. That's why we have a rule of law. And so I think today's action is obviously warranted. I know that there'll potentially be some Florida Senate could potentially see this depending on how things are going out. But I just think that to take a position that you have veto power over the laws of this state is untenable. And I think it warrants the suspension and eventual removal of office.
Next is Tucker Carlson's interview of DeSantos about the suspending of this attorney, and Andrew Warren, I think is his name. So this coming up next is what Tucker Carlson had to say, actually interviewed Governor DeSantos, and really insightful. And then I'm going to play what the local sheriff down there had to say about trying to clean up this crime problem that's been created by the changes of defunding and so forth and releasing people on no bail and so forth. So here we go next. Actually, the DAs and these attorneys have not been prosecuting cases they should have been prosecuting. So the neglect in prosecuting has created this crime wave. So here we go next with what Tucker Carlson's interview with Governor DeSantis.
So it's kind of amazing and a little jarring to see a Republican politician actually do something about something. All of us have known about Soros-backed prosecutors for a long time and the effect they're having on the country, like a lot of people dying. But it wasn't until today that anyone actually acted, and that would be Governor Ron DeSantis of Florida, who just sacked a Soros-backed prosecutor in Tampa called Andrew Warren. For more than 6 years, Andrew Warren was refusing to enforce laws that he didn't like. Well, as promised, Governor DeSantis joins us right now to discuss why he did this. Governor, thanks so much for coming on. So this is kind of a big move, it seems like. Why did you do it?
Well, Tucker, you documented the destruction that we've seen with these Soros prosecutors around the country, where they basically take it upon themselves to determine which laws should be followed and which laws should not be followed. And I can tell you, in Florida's constitution, that constitution vests the veto power in the governor, not an individual district attorney or a state attorney where they can pick and choose. And so I asked my staff to review all state attorneys in the state of Florida. I wanted to see who was picking and choosing. And this is the guy that all the line prosecutors, all the law enforcement said he thinks he can pick and choose which laws. And he actually signed letters saying he wouldn't force laws against transgender surgeries for minors, laws protecting the right to life. And then he has all these policies in his agency that are called presumptive non-prosecution. No, the law is presumptively enforced. That's not something that's acceptable.
Right.
And so we there today, we made the decision. The jarring thing about it, though, Tucker, I had all these sheriffs from the area there. I had the former police chief in Tampa. There's a lot of line prosecutors in that office that are very happy that this was done. And so we took it seriously. We did a thorough review. And we pulled the trigger today.
I mean, it's so obviously unconstitutional. Legislatures make the laws. Judges decide whether they're consistent with the Constitution. Prosecutors have no role in that. They don't have the legal right, the constitutional right, to selectively enforce the law. Or am I missing something?
No, you're right. But here's what Soros is doing. It's actually smart on his part. They can't get these things enacted in a legislature where you're just going to let criminals run. So what they do, he will get involved in these Democrat primaries in a Democrat area. He'll flush $1 million to get the radical to win the primary. Then they usually win the general because of the party affiliation difference in the jurisdiction. So then you get him in there. And what they do is they want to change the criminal justice system through non-enforcement. So it's a total end run around our constitutional system. The results obviously have been destructive around the country, but it also really undermines the idea that ours is supposed to be a government of laws, not a government of individual men.
Even if I agreed with the results, I would hate it, because it's a subversion of democracy. And I finally, someone's doing something more than wine. Thank you, Governor DeSantis, for coming on tonight. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Tucker.
Next, we have the sheriff, okay, Grady Judd. Actually, I didn't follow, you know, DeSantis' announcement, but this is what the Polk County sheriff had to say, and his name is Grady Judd, and about this dismissal or this suspending of this attorney by Governor DeSantis. And this was a big deal for them because it really spoke loudly that, hey, you start neglecting prosecutions you should have been following and proceeding on, then we're gonna suspend you and get rid of you. And so this is the Polk County sheriff speaking immediately after DeSantis made his announcement. Did this a little bit out of order, but I wanted to get that Tucker Carlson interview in there also. Here we go next with the Polk County sheriff.
Thank you very much, Governor. It's truly my honor to be a Florida sheriff. And I can tell you, I've done this job my entire adult life. I remember, Governor, when the felons owned Florida. It was in the 70s and 80s. I remember that well. I was one of the cops on the street when we couldn't keep the felons locked up. We couldn't keep the criminals locked up, and they preyed on the community. And, Governor, they didn't prey on the ones behind the gated communities in the million and half million dollar homes. They preyed on what I call the real working people. And then a magic thing happened. We changed the laws. We decided to hold them accountable. And Governor, it was a Democrat governor that signed the legislation that started us down the path originally to make a positive difference. Now I look around the country today. I've seen a few things. I was recently the president of the Major County Sheriffs of America. I talked to and counseled with the sheriffs from the largest jurisdictions in the entire nation, to include the Los Angeles Sheriff's Office. In fact, the sheriff there was my vice president of the association at one time. And you know what they tell me? They tell me we got a dumpster fire going on in this nation. And you know who's getting burned by this dumpster fire? The working people. You know, it's not safe for people to walk the streets. The homeless aren't being looked out for. The mentally ill aren't being looked out for, and it's by the major people. Now, Governor, I know you'd be disappointed if you didn't see some cards. So let me give you a snapshot of the people that joined Prosecutor Warren in not enforcing the law. We just want to enforce the law. It's the prosecutor in New Orleans. Per capita, it's the highest murder rate in the United States. You're going to see a common theme here in a minute. San Francisco, where businesses are closing, where they threw the prosecutor out because they weren't holding criminals accountable. Chicago, I think that speaks for itself. Los Angeles, where the sheriff told me, I've got 60,000 homeless. We have criminals running wild. We have innocent people being victimized. And who's responsible there? The prosecutor. The chief prosecutor who's allowing it to occur. He has the law. He has the tools. Baltimore, Maryland. But that's not all. And there's one of our favorite places, Portland, Oregon. You can set up a CHOP zone there and just not let the cops come in. You know how long there'd be a CHOP zone in Polk County? As long as it takes me to drive back there from here. New York, where they're not holding people accountable. Seattle, Washington, and Washington, D.C. So what's the commonality here? Just go look for yourself. Look at the data. The murders are up. Innocent people are being murdered where prosecutors don't do their job. My friend Chad Cronister just gave you an example. We don't have time to stand here all day. But listen, Prosecutor Warren, like the rest of us who ran for public office, we ask for your precious vote in order to enforce the law and do what was right. Then we took an oath to tell the truth, to uphold the Constitution, and to support the laws and the government. And we do that. And we're led by the greatest governor in the United States of America. But there are some, and it's the elected prosecutors that sign the papers that said they won't prosecute. Not we'll evaluate it case by case. We won't prosecute. You know, they're not God. They're not the legislature. So at the end of the day, ladies and gentlemen, this is about protecting the community we serve. This is about keeping people safe. And when you look at the highest murder rates, when you look where the quality of life is lowest, you look at the prosecutor who does not support law enforcement, who does not do what's right. Our governor does what's right. And Governor, I appreciate from the bottom of my heart you setting the example and doing the right thing and keeping the people safe. And the exciting thing is you not only protect the people behind the gated communities, you protect the people who clean the gates on those communities. Thank you. God bless you.
The Polk County sheriff had spoke very loudly. He spoke to the point and told us exactly what's been going on down there in Tampa and in that county. And this prosecutor especially was not prosecuting cases that he should have prosecuted. But coming up next is we're going back in time to G. Edward Griffin's speech given on December 10th, 2009 at the AT&T Convention Center on the campus of the UT, University of Texas, campus in Austin, Texas. And G. Edward Griffin was speaking, and he spoke insightfully about the Constitution and then began to talk about the creature from Jekyll Island and the conspiracy to create the Fed, which is privately owned. But anyway, we're going to put that up next, and then we'll end with the dimming, a part of the dimming. I'll not only put the complete dimming up, okay, about climate change engineering, but I'll also put up a click-off that will enable you to see totally the G. Edward Griffin speech given at the University of Texas. So anyway, that's what we've got going next. And so here we go now with G. Edward Griffin, just a snippet. But I'll put the full speech up so you can listen to its entirety. So here we go next with G. Edward Griffin.
You know, G. Edward Griffin had a profound effect on me. He gave me an education for $25 that I didn't get with a $30,000 degree. So I'm tempted to ask UT for my money back, but I guess giving us this place to hold this is a start. So we'll take it on a layaway. I just wanted to express my thanks to Mr. Griffin for writing that book, and I think everybody needs to read that book. If you're studying history, if you're not really into history, it doesn't matter. It's a very rich lesson in civics and understanding where we came from and where we are in history. And I think everybody needs to understand it. It's a very, very important topic of how money works, where it comes from, who makes it, more importantly, and what that means for us. But I'll let him have a profound effect on you guys tonight. And afterwards, you can go purchase the book at Brave New Books if you feel so inclined. And Mr. Griffin will sign it for you. But without further ado, I'd like to introduce the legend, even though he doesn't like me to say that, the legend, Mr. G. Edward Griffin. Please give it up.
Thank you so much. I love being a legend. Well, I'm really disoriented tonight. I came expecting that, well, I'll walk in the room, will be, you know, maybe 60 or 100 people, and I'll get up on the stage and then talk for about an hour, and then that'll be it. But I'm so fired up listening to what's happened already, and by seeing the size of this audience, I'm thinking I should just throw out my speech and do something else. Two things I decided I definitely wanted to do. One is I want to move to this town. And the other thing, as I noticed after John took a drink of that water, he gave such a fiery talk. I want to drink that whole bottle over here. That was wonderful, John. I really appreciate your depth of the problem and your solution. Thank you. I came with my money hat on to talk about the Federal Reserve System and money, but I'm going to take it off just for a few minutes because of you, John, and I'm put my ideology hat on and my Constitution hat because you triggered a couple of thoughts that I thought were so important. You were talking about the Constitution and how wonderful it was and how many unusual concepts were put into it for the first time in history. This was quite a rare document. It was the first time in history that a revolution had been fought and the victorious side declined to simply declare themselves to be the new monarchy. I mean, that's the old style, right? You overthrow the king because you didn't like the king, because he didn't do what you liked, and he wasn't fair to your group, and so forth. You overthrew the king, and then you became the king. And it didn't take long because of the adage that we know that power corrupts. So if you're the king, now you've got the power, you become corrupted. And if you don't, by the way, the guy that comes along after you surely as heck will. So people have always focused on replacing people, replacing kings, monarchs, the bad guys, and they've never looked at the system. They always thought the system was okay, when reality has always been the system that was the problem and not the people. Because as long as the system has the ability to give human beings the power over other human beings, then that is going to corrupt human beings. It's as simple as that. And so our founding fathers came along and they got a hold of that concept, and they decided to change the system. Wow, what a thought. And so they wrote this thing we call the Constitution, which is, on one view, you can look at it and say it's a bunch of rules and regulations and directions of how to run a state. But if you really analyze it, it's a system of checks and balances and, as Jefferson called it, chains. You remember after the Constitution had been written, Jefferson was engaged in correspondence with one of his friends, and his friend said, "Mr. Jefferson, now that we have this new system in place, how can we be sure that only just men are elected to office?" And those of you who remember this quote, remember Jefferson responded almost irately. He said, "Speak to me not of just men. Rather, let us bind men down with the chains of the Constitution." And in that simple statement, it was a fabulous political philosophy, which really was the essence of our whole republic, to bind men down. He was saying, of course we're not going to have just men. Duh. Of course scoundrels are going to be attracted into bureaucratic positions, because as long as we give them the power to abuse other human beings under the protection of government, they're going to take advantage of that, of course. So we should not design a system that will ensure that only just men are elected to office. We must design a system that will assume that scoundrels will be elected to office, and design the system so that even the scoundrels cannot take away our liberty. It's as simple as that. Well, as John pointed out so eloquently, this was kind of a radical departure in history, and it was a wonderful departure, and it worked for about 100 years. But now the reality creeps in. It didn't last, did it? It wasn't perfect. If it had been perfect in some way, or in all ways, why, we would still have the chains of the Constitution. But now we know with this experience that, well, actually, the process started almost from the very first administration, the Washington administration. There were pressures and opinions and movements within the newly formed government to begin to break those chains of the Constitution. And although it was very small in the beginning, with the passage of time, and especially with the passage of the generation that died off and forgot all of these concepts, had forgotten the spirit of the American Revolution, who'd forgotten the heavy weight of the rule from England, forgotten all those things, with new generations coming up and new prosperity, all of these things faded into history, and people forgot to take a look at those chains, and one by one they were broken, one link by another. So today we have practically no links left in the Constitution. And so it's our job, it's our privilege, it is our duty to repair the chain. And I think that if we look at it that way, it becomes a very exhilarating challenge for us, because we can look at the Constitution, which in my view was a beta model. In history, I think maybe 100 years from now or 200 years from now, people will look back and say, the American Constitution was a magnificent beta model. Now, with the experience of our era and the energy and the brain power and the consciousness of people like us, we will now design the second model, and we will build upon that experience and make it even better. Instead of lasting 100 years, maybe it'll last 500 years. And then it will probably fail, too, because we won't see everything. But then at the end of the 500 years, there will be a new group of people who say, aha, the model number two was better than model number one, but it had some problems with it. So now we'll build model number three, and that will last for 5,000 years. And this is how the revolution continues. And that was John Stanley. I'd like to add just one little specific contribution to what I think will be an important addition to the second model. I think perhaps the greatest mistake that was made at the creation of our wonderful republic was because the founding fathers understandably but accidentally adopted the wrong word to describe the system they were creating. They used the word government. They said, what kind of government are we going to build here? And in the founding documents, you say it's government does this, government does that. Well, think about it. What is the proper function of government? By definition, it is to govern. That's a mistake. The founding fathers used the word government because that was the word that was in use at the time. That's what they always had. The world had governments. People were always governed by the state. And so they just adopted the word because that was it. But what they created was not a government at all. They created what I would suggest should have been called a protectorate. They created a state that was designed not to govern the people, but to protect the people, to protect their lives, liberty, and property, nothing more. And that's what they created. And I believe that if they had the foresight to have used the word protectorate in all of their writings, then all of the school children for generations thereafter would be talking about this thing called a protectorate. And the very use of the word would trigger off the definition of what is the proper function of the state. And you see what an assist that would be. So I suggest that when we all get together and do this second model, we're going to use a different word. Let's use the word protectorate. So now I'll take my Constitution hat off and put my money hat back on. And I know that money is a topic that's very much in the minds of many people. And as you folks know, I'm here in Austin primarily to do a one-day seminar called A Crash Course on Money. And I hope that many of you will be able to attend it. I'll be talking about things in that seminar entirely different from my topic here this evening. The motivation for most people coming to the seminar is that they want to have an idea, a better idea, of what they can do to protect themselves in this economic perfect storm that is approaching. In fact, it's not really approaching anymore. We used to talk about, see those clouds over there on the horizon, those big black clouds? You know, one of these days we're going to have a real problem. Well, now the darn things are right overhead, and it's not really approaching. It's here. We're beginning to feel the winds and the rain and the snow and all of that right now. And people want to know, how can they protect themselves in the short run? How can they protect their assets? Because, you know, there's going to be a lot of inflation ahead. We'll talk about inflation versus deflation and what sectors will be affected, in my opinion at least, which will be affected by deflation for a while and which ones will be subject to massive inflation. We'll talk about what you can do about it and what investments there may be that are still viable in this crisis period. And most importantly, we'll be talking about how to repair the system, so it won't be just a question of survival, but how to make a system that will benefit our children and our grandchildren as well. I think any discussion of these issues that doesn't have the long view of history is very, very deficient. And if we don't look at the system, you know, if we have all the money in the world, but we lose the freedom to enjoy it, we've made a huge mistake. To me, it's like counting your money on the sinking Titanic. You don't get the whole picture. But anyway, tonight, I realize that there are a lot of people who may not have been familiar with my work on the Federal Reserve System. And so what I'm going to do is take a condensation of my original talk that I've given so many times over the years on the Federal Reserve System called The Creature from Jekyll Island, and condense it down into a much smaller, manageable segment, and then follow it with a short overview of what I think the situation looks like today, what's happened since the book was published, and kind of a brief view of where I think we're headed. And then I think we'll probably be out of time. And you may remember that those of you who have heard what I call my original recipe talk, generally it was called The Creature from Jekyll Island, just like the book. But in reality, it had a different title, that at least I intended it to be known as under a different title, which was An Appearance of the Fourth Kind. Somebody giggled or hummed on that, so you know where I'm going with this now. And that statement is based on a quotation taken from an obscure philosopher by the name of Epictetus, who lived in I think it was the 3rd century B.C. in an obscure kingdom called Phrygia. And he was a philosopher, and some of his writings survived and have been translated. And I ran across one of the most amazing quotations I've ever read attributed to Epictetus. And this is it. Epictetus said, "Appearances are of four kinds. Things either are as they appear to be, or they neither are nor appear to be, or they are but do not appear to be, or they are not and yet appear to be." I know everybody's got that. It's amazing how confusing that sounds when in reality it's just a simple concept. You know, I figured that if Epictetus were alive today, he'd probably be the chairman of the Federal Reserve System or Harvard professor of money theory or something like that. What he said was pretty simple, but he made it confusing with his explanation. What he said was appearances are of four kinds. Things either are or they aren't. There's two. And then regardless of which they are, they can appear to be the opposite. So there's four. Why didn't he just say so? No. Well, because he was practicing for a career in banking. So anyway, the appearance of the fourth kind was, as you remember, is those things which are not and yet appear to be. And that's the best explanation I could think of at the time for the Federal Reserve System, because we all expect it to be a government agency. It's not. We expect it to be in the interests of the American people. It's not. All of these things that people think about the Federal Reserve System is a complete reversal of its reality.
We'll be ending this program. We'll play as much as we can about the dimming, and it's really a fine documentary about climate, geoengineering of our climate. But anyway, here we go next with the dimming, and we'll put up a click off on the secrettruth.com site. We'll have a click off for you to watch the dimming. It's in entirety, and go to the main, website also. So here we go with the dimming, the part as much as we can play till the end of this first hour.
Perhaps the greatest lie ever perpetrated on populations all over the world is the condensation trail lie. What we're seeing in our skies is not condensation. It's sprayed particulate dispersions with very few exceptions.
They shouldn't be there. Jet engines burn clean. So if there's anything coming out of them, it's an additive.
They're absolutely not contrails. Contrails do not linger, dissipate, and go into cloud coverage, period, in the report.
And I kept saying to people, you know, what is this? Because now the sky is no longer blue. It's starting to turn gray. And what I found was kind of like it was not socially acceptable. You know, we're all going to pretend this is not really happening. And I thought, oh, this is very bad.
Most are unfamiliar with the science term called global dimming. That term refers to the amount of direct sunlight that no longer reaches the surface of the planet due to light scattering particles that are building up in the atmosphere. And although many of these particles are from industrialized pollution, the larger majority are from the ongoing climate engineering solar radiation management operations. this engine, a high bypass turbofan jet engine, this is the engine that is on all military tankers and all commercial carriers, is in essence a jet powered fan. 90% of the air that moves through this engine is non-combusted. This engine, by design, is nearly incapable of producing any condensation trail except under rare and extreme circumstances. And again, we have film footage of aircraft flying at altitude with nozzles visible, turning on and off. That is the end of the argument. Since even before man could fly, there was an effort to try to modify the weather. We have weather modification patents going back 100 years plus. These are historical films of what can be done with a biplane, a small biplane that carries a very small payload, and that much can be done. How much more can a fully loaded military tanker, KC-10, KC-135, C-17 Globemaster, how much more material can they put in the air? About 500 times more with a single tanker. In regard to the condensation trail narrative, many refer back to the trails left by World War II bombers as proof that we are only seeing condensation trails in our skies. But GeoengineeringWatch.org found on military archives film footage, which we posted, of World War II B-17s at altitude turning off a sprayed dispersion. We know that climate engineering was deployed immediately after World War II, so testing was absolutely ongoing. Clearly, these bombers were used for beta testing. Film footage proves it.
Weather was a weapon used over Vietnam. Would you expect that to be then deleted from the availability? No. To continue to expand the scientific aspects of it, to have it available in your portfolio of weapons, would be a natural process. Therefore, should you expect that it is available on demand to have the ability to modify weather? Absolutely, within this country and others.
Climate engineering is the crown jewel of the military-industrial complex. Climate engineering has been used to destabilize and topple nations all over the globe, facilitating military occupations by hostile countries like the U.S. We know that some of these countries are having their precipitation cut off because they have stated so on the floor of the U.N., like the president of Iran stating emphatically that NATO weather modification programs were cutting off the precipitation to Iran, but U.S. media never covered it.
We have an economic model operating globally, which is operating based on covert force. And I have very serious questions after watching the financial patterns as to whether that financial force or that force includes weather warfare.
People were coming to me telling me about this. So because of that, I went to the government in Ottawa under freedom of information. There was a 40-page report, of which half the pages were completely blank, and the other half had a lot of blank outs. But there was sufficient information to tell me that, yeah, they're aware. They call it geoengineering.
One of the big problems is that when we find some new technology, we get all excited by it, by the potential benefits of that technology. And often implement it and use the technology before we have any idea of the negative effects.
Shouldn't it be considered that every breath we take is laden with highly toxic particles that are wreaking havoc in our own bodies?